Good morning. On today's program, US President Donald Trump has threatened to send the military to Nigeria in order to protect Christians there. And, more than 30 years on from gaining independence, Slovenia still has challenges in protecting its linguistic culture while also recognizing the rights of other ethnicities. First, to Ukraine, where due to constant threat of Russian attacks, the train route from Kyiv to Kramatorsk, a city in the Donetsk region about 20 kilometers from the front line of the war, has been closed indefinitely. The train line to Kramatorsk was used by thousands of people seeing off soldiers heading to the front, as well as greeting those returning. However, it has now become much more complicated to reach the city near the front line, as Emmanuel Chase reports.
The Kyiv-Kramatorsk train can't run up to its final destination anymore. The final stops of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk in Donetsk region have become too dangerous, as Russia now targets railway infrastructure all along the front line. I was on board this train often, and each time it was an important lesson in what this war is about. What is that journey about? A Kyiv-Kramatorsk journey begins very early, with an alarm clock ringing at 5 a.m. and a race to Kyiv's main station to catch the Kramatorsk-bound train, which departs still at 6:44 in the morning, sharp, no matter what. At dawn, hundreds of people with red eyes, from crying from exhaustion after a night of Russian air raids, hop on or say goodbye to their cherished relatives who are going on board. It is called the love train by some of us because it links families to their loved ones from across the country, from the rear to the front line, soldiers with their lives in many ways. It is a war train too. On the racks, camouflage bags in all shades of green show the presence of servicemen returning from permission. Chevrons show legendary brigades fighting in the directions of Lyman, Kostiantynivka or Pokrovsk. As the train departs, the sun rises and basks the statue of Mother Ukraine in a beautiful pink light or wraps her up in a fog, depending on the weather. The train lulls us away from the capital. It is quiet, apart from the back and forth of the coffee trolley that circulates across our carriages. At 9 a.m. sharp, the daily minute of silence and the stern countdown in memory of all the people who gave their lives defending Ukraine plunges each carriage into an atmosphere of deep and quiet reflection. Some people stand, others just bow their heads. In Ukraine, everybody knows in their flesh the price of blood paid for the country to remain free. On board, everybody is involved in the war, humanitarians, journalists, soldiers, and their families. Yet it is a train full of life. Each ride brought back home dozens of people uprooted from Donbas and coming back to visit their relatives left behind, and dozens of wives, girlfriends, and children of soldiers. Riding this train slowly heading towards Donbas, through the hills of Poltava and the vast fields of Kharkiv oblasts, is a travel through Ukraine's rich landscapes and a travel through its history. The closer one gets to Donbas, the more visible the war becomes. As the scenery passes by the window, it fills with ever more grey, dark green, and all shades of military vehicles that drive towards or come back from the front line. There are scenes of ordinary lives, babusias, grandmothers on their bicycles, mothers in pink hoodies walking their toddlers. Then there is the Ukrainian railway message upon arriving in Kramatorsk. Thank you for your support. Our trains are getting ready to return to Donetsk, Luhansk, Mariupol and Simferopol. See you soon on Ukrainian railways. Each time, arriving in Kramatorsk felt like it could be the last. Earlier this summer, seeing the Lozova station in Kharkiv region in ruins foreboded the worst. It was only a matter of time until the Kyiv-Kramatorsk would stop running up until its final destination. At each station, emotional reunions of families and lovers took place on the platforms. But the most moving of all happened in Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. As the train finally came to a stop and the doors opened, we all knew one has to walk away from the station as quickly as possible, as it is Russia's target of choice. Yet time stopped right here. Tired but happy-looking men in military clothes of all ages welcomed their wives, fiancés and girlfriends with tight embraces that let all their exhaustion and relief transpire. So many tears, most of happiness. Each hug is a victory against the aggressor. Each reunion a blessing for one soldier and his family. Finally, love. Finally, this long-awaited hug. Love through blood and sweat, and the smell of Ukraine's soil and its hundreds of posadkas, the hiding lairs where tens of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers shelter along the front line. Love, the only thing that still makes sense, the one thing everybody fights for. This love persists despite all this blood, all this misery, all this horror, all those killer drones. The love train no longer brings together lovers on Kramatorsk's platform. It is a tragedy. It was a handy commodity for thousands of passengers. But to think that love can be stopped because of the aggressor would be to grossly underestimate what Ukrainians are capable of, what love is capable of. Life will be tougher for soldiers in that sector. Travel will become even more uneasy. But there will be other routes. There will be other reunions. And there will be love. Always. Emmanuel Chaz for RT's World Report, between Kyiv and Kramatorsk.
Next, to Nigeria, where US President Donald Trump has threatened to send a military force to the African country to protect Christians from attacks. For years, Nigeria has struggled to curtail violence in its country, ranging from international terrorist groups to disputes between farmers and herders. The US has now designated Nigeria a country of particular concern under the International Religious Freedoms Act. This means it is accused of violating religious freedoms, as Pallam David reports.
So, a few days ago, a video started trending on social media, and honestly, it was hard to watch. In the video, a pastor from Plateau State in north-central Nigeria, Reverend Ezekiel Dachomo, was standing in front of dead bodies. He was leading the burial of more than a dozen people who were killed by armed insurgents in October. Around him, hundreds of mourners cried and wailed. You could feel the pain in their voices. Pastor Dachomo said he was bitter. He said he was tired of performing burials every day, tired of watching people he knows, his friends, his church members, neighbors, die in attacks. He said he could no longer keep quiet. Later that night, while scrolling through Facebook, I came across another video, a woman crying as she shared how her husband was killed. She said they had just stepped out of choir practice when insurgents surrounded their community. She managed to escape with her children, but her husband wasn't so lucky. He was captured and brutally murdered. These are not isolated stories. For many people in Nigeria's north central region, this kind of tragedy happens far too often. Pastor Dachomo and the Christian community say they are tired of the killings. They are begging for help from the Nigerian government, the United Nations, and even from the United States. Dachomo said he shared that heartbreaking video online so that the world will not deny or forget what he calls an ongoing Christian genocide. But he says that ever since he spoke out, he has received death threats, yet he says he won't stop talking. Now, to understand why this keeps happening, you need to know a bit about Nigeria's geography. The country is split almost evenly between Muslims in the north and Christians in the south. In the Middle Belt, which is also known as the North Central, both sides meet, and that is where tensions often explode. Many of these attacks are linked to clashes between Muslim Fulani herders and mostly Christian farming communities. The herders move with their cattle across Nigeria in search of grazing land while the farmers try to protect their crops. With limited access to water and pasture, these conflicts turn deadly. A recent report by the International Society for Civil Liberties and Rule of Law claims that militants have killed more than 7,000 Christians and abducted nearly 8,000 others this year alone. It also alleges that over 19,000 churches have been destroyed since 2009. Those are very shocking numbers. But not everyone agrees with calling this a genocide. Nigerian officials say the violence is more about land and resources than religion. Gimba Kakanda, who is an advisor to President Bola Tinubu, said, "The Fulani herders are mostly Muslim while the farmers come from diverse groups. This can create an illusion of religious war, but both sides have been perpetrators and victims." Even data from the US-based Acled Research Group suggests that out of nearly 2,000 attacks on civilians in Nigeria this year, only about 50 specifically targeted Christians because of their faith. Things took a dramatic turn internationally when US President Donald Trump waded into the issue. After Nigeria was relisted as a country of particular concern, meaning it is accused of violating religious freedoms, Trump threatened to take military action. In a fiery social media post, he said the US might go into Nigeria guns a-blazing. if the government doesn't stop the killing of Christians. The Nigerian government, however, responded quickly. Officials said there is no Christian genocide and that the US cannot unilaterally take military action against the sovereign country. An advisor to President Tinubu, Daniel Bwala, said Nigeria welcomes help in fighting terrorism, but there is no discrimination against tribe or religion. Meanwhile, the tension spilled across borders. Chad, Nigeria's northern neighbor, even announced it was closing its borders over fears of instability and reports of possible US military movements in the region. Nigeria's military says it is conducting airstrikes and special operations against the armed groups. President Tinubu recently replaced the country's security chiefs in an attempt to strengthen the response. But people say the real problem runs deeper. There are issues of poverty, youth unemployment, and weak governance that have made violence a way of life in some parts of the country. Being listed as a country of particular concern might seem like just another diplomatic tag, but it can lead to sanctions, aid cuts, or restrictions from the US unless exceptions are made for national security reasons. Nigeria was placed on that list back in 2020 during Trump's first administration and then removed in 2021 under President Biden. Now it's back, and with it, renewed tension between both nations. Analysts say Nigeria's lack of a strong diplomatic presence in Washington has made it more vulnerable to US pressure. But beyond the politics, the people of Nigeria are asking for accountability. They want a government that protects its citizens no matter their religion. They want justice for victims and consequences for attackers. And security forces should be properly funded and equipped. Because at the end of the day, the real story here is not about statistics or foreign policy. It is about families like that woman who lost her husband and pastors like Ezekiel Dachemo who are tired of burying their friends. For World Reports in Abuja, Nigeria, I am Polum David.
Over 30 years on from its independence from Yugoslavia, the small state of Slovenia has managed to retain its own official language while recognizing the rights of other ethnicities within its borders. Slovenian is the official language, but Italian and Hungarian have special status under the constitution, while members of the Roma community also have special linguistic rights, as Pader King reports.
When asked, "What's up in the city?" the taxi driver who took my companion and me from the airport to the center of Ljubljana, Slovenia's capital city, replied, "Nothing happens in Ljubljana." The taxi driver's response reminded me of the late and much celebrated writer Benedict Kiely, whose once distinctively mellifluous Ulster voice filled the airways of this station. In Kiely's 1985 novel, Nothing Happens in Carmen Cross, the spectre of bombs and political murder hung over his idyllic Carmen Cross. Thankfully for the people here, a newly independent Slovenia was birthed without the spectre of bombs that hung over Carmen Cross. It did not, however, transition to independence unscathed. In 1991, after a brief 10-day war between the Yugoslav People's Army and Slovenia's Territorial Defence Forces, 79 people were killed, a year in which Slovenia declared independence from a disintegrating Yugoslavia. The country was spared the human carnage and destruction that marked the war that engulfed the rest of the former Yugoslavia over the following 10 years. Throughout its history, this small Slavic country has retained its independent spirit and its distinctive language, while English is widely spoken, as we encountered everywhere. Once, as we struggled with the ticket machine in the railway station that leads to the stunningly beautiful alpine town and lake of Bled, listed by the Lonely Planet as among the top 10 global destinations, three young teenage girls came to our rescue. In flawless English, they explained the intricacies of the machine. "Where did you learn your English?" my companion asked. "From YouTube and American movies," came the confident replies. "We even speak better English than our teacher," one boasted. "She speaks with a German accent. We speak perfect English." Another Slovenian landmark, this time the extraordinary limestone Šikotjan Caves, now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, in the karst region in the southwestern part of the country, and one of 10,000 caves in Slovenia. akin to, but much larger than, the Alwi Cave in the karst region of the Burn in County Clare. We queue along with a group of second-level students, this time in their late teens, who also, in flawless English, direct us to the tourist entry to the cave. The Sí Caitéan caves run underground for 6 kilometres through stunning waterfalls and roaring rapids, and feature an awe-inspiring underground chamber, 150 metres in height and 120 metres in length. Within are stalagmites and stalactites, the likes of which we had never seen. Everywhere we go, we encounter flawless English, but the language of the street is Slovenian, a language that belongs to a group of South Slavic languages that includes Croatian, Bosnian, Serbian, Montenegrin, Macedonian and Bulgarian. Curious to know how this language has survived in this melting pot of languages in a country with a population of just 2.1 million people, I asked Dr. Lara Gotez-Soršak, Assistant Professor of Slovenian Language at Ljubljana University. The Slovenian language is synonymous with the existence of the nation, she tells me. The first book in Slovenian was written in 1550 by Primož Trubar, a Protestant reformer in the Lutheran tradition. When other writers began to write important and high-quality works in Slovenian, we as a nation had proof that our language could be on a par with the great world languages. This gave us self-confidence and confirmation as a nation, she went on to say. While Slovenian is the official language of the country and has first language status, Italian, spoken in the Slovenian Istria region in the southwest of the country, close to the border with Italy, has special status under the constitution, as has Hungarian, spoken in the Primorje region in the northeast of the country, close to the border with Hungary. The Slovenian poet Franca Prešeren, who lived in the first half of the 19th century, is regarded as an important figure in the development of the Slovenian language. The seventh stanza of his poem Istrolice is also the anthem of the Republic of Slovenia. Long live all the nations who long to see the day when where the sun travels, strife shall be banished from the world. That every countryman will be free, not an enemy, but a neighbour shall the foreigner be. Whether or not our taxi friend was right as to whether nothing happens in Ljubljana remains an open question. Probably not. But one thing is certain. While English is on the rise, particularly among the young, the rest of the world has much to learn from Slovenia about accommodating languages, ethnicity, and about peaceful coexistence with one's neighbours. That in itself is enough to be getting on with. Something is definitely happening in Slovenia, and it feels good. For World Report, this is Padre King in Ljubljana, Slovenia.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Ethna Dodd, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.